I mean, I don't think I've, from most people's view, or maybe I don't think mathematics is anything holy or foundations are absolute, but I think this Wittgenstein view, there's this place, a deep misunderstanding what's the role of logic in mathematical reasoning.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to our newest episode. And today we have a great friend of ours, Jose Perez Escobar, who's professor at UNED, which is the distance university of Spain in Madrid, and is a longtime collaborator of mine. We too, with Jordi Ferrest, who was also a guest in the last season, we started the Young Network for Wittgensteinian Philosophy. He's doing a lot on Wittgenstein, and we will definitely talk about it. But he's also a neuroscientist and psychologist turned philosopher, so we will also talk about that. So I'm very happy that you accepted our invitation to be part of About Logic.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, I'm also pleased to see you again. I think we met once at this in Lübeck, right? There was this meeting on Fibonacci's garden.
It was a couple of years ago or 1 year and a half ago. Yeah, we met indeed in the Fibonacci's garden workshop.
Yeah, it was quite an interesting meeting, lots of stuff. But maybe you can tell our listeners and also remind me, what are you working on in the moment?
Well, at the moment, I'm working on several topics in the philosophy of mathematics, but also generally in the philosophy of science. Maybe I would say my main topic right now, if I have to choose one, is the applicability of mathematics to the sciences. So we would say the philosophy of applied mathematics. But I have also worked quite a bit on Wittgenstein and a bit on the philosophy of biology.
So, yeah, maybe can you comment on why is mathematics so useful in sciences? Have you got any idea about this?
Well, are they useful? That's the first question.
They
are indeed. They're used a lot and they're very useful, of course. Actually, this is...
Of course, but why?
This is a paraphrase of what we call Wigner's enigma, which is basically he was puzzled that that mathematics is so useful in science that we should find out why, but in principle it's like something that we don't even deserve, that it's a gift from the gods. So... of course, for philosophers, this is not an acceptable state of affairs of the question. So we need to get into the details of what makes mathematics so applicable and useful, and why does it yield predictions that otherwise we wouldn't be able to get. So that's actually one of my main concerns in the philosophy of applied mathematics. And I did work on a paper that, well, it has been published for 3 years already, that directly engages with that question. And this actually combines this topic with Wittgenstein, because I used later Wittgensteinian philosophy of mathematics to explain why mathematics is so applicable to the real world.
Yeah, just what's I was thinking. So sometimes people sort of, or in the history, we sort of misapplied mathematics. Wasn't there a theory that that the distances of the planets could be explained by sort of platonic solids? Do you know the story? I mean, there was some calculation that all the planets are explained by certain poliedas, but which wasn't, had nothing, I mean, predicted something which was not compatible with reality. Or do you know maybe other examples? Yeah.
So that's a good point, because we used to think that mathematics is something that works all the time, but anyone that knows a certain episode in the history of science knows that mathematics can also fail in science. But I mean, the point, some people would say, to play devil's advocate, they would say that the problem is not the mathematics, but it's the mathematician or the scientist that is using the mathematics that maybe overgeneralized some mathematical model or misapplied the model, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the mathematics' fault. I guess that's what many people would say.
Yeah, in that direction, I mean, it's not only about doing math, right? You use math for theory development, like physicists saying, oh, it should be simple, it should be elegant, whatever that exactly means, right? And I mean, assuming that some planets form a platonic solid would be beautiful in some sense because we like these forms, but it's not empirically valid simply, right? You can look into the world. While it could still be an interesting hypothesis, and maybe it's useful to do that. Maybe it's not useful. Maybe it's in the way of getting to truth, to new hypothesis, to switch to messier mathematics that describe things better. I mean, in some sense, Einstein's math is harder than Newton's math, right? And maybe it's also more beautiful for people. But yeah, sorry, Thorsten.
So yeah, I just thought this some of these ideas, they were born out of this Platonic idea that sort of everything has to be perfect and ideal, and that the real world is sort of an imperfect reflection of this perfect world of ideas. And so then it was also, I mean, assumed that the planets would go in a circular orbit because that was just more perfect than what they actually do.
Even epicircles and circles on circles stuff, just because we love circles.
Yes. And just about Einstein. I mean, isn't it what Einstein was doing? He had sort of an intuitive idea, which was based on observations. And then he worked very hard to turn this beautiful, this intuitive idea into mathematics. And that became, I mean, first special relativity, which is based on the simple idea that speed of light is the same for every observer, and then general relativity, which is also based on some simple ideas that sort of gravity and acceleration are indistinguishable. So, yeah, can you comment on this, Jose? Does this fit with what you're thinking?
I guess with regard to the topic, the point would be, why did he choose mathematics as the language to translate his intuition onto instead of another language? And that's what states his confidence in mathematics as the language for his science, or in this case, his intuitions. The point is, even with idealizations, there are plenty of idealizations in physics. Even with that, mathematics remains extremely useful in physics. And not only physics, also other domains. Maybe not that much in other domains. In biology, mathematics has its own specific problems, for instance. But despite that, why is it so useful in physics? Why don't we use natural language to formulate theories in physics? And the intuitions that I formulate in this work is that mathematics does not only describe reality. It's not only, as most people believe, it's a language that is rich enough that captures structural properties of the world in a way that other language can't. But also, in the line of the later Wittgenstein philosophy of mathematics, mathematics can also constitute rules of description, not just descriptions. So, let's say you have a mathematical model, the typical example, a mathematical model for apple addition, and your model is 2 + 2 = 4. Then if you are in the supermarket and you have 2 apples on one hand and 2 apples in the other, and you put them together and then you only count 3, then you know that probably your model is not wrong. What is wrong is your measurement procedure, for instance, just to put a very simple example. So your model acts as a reference for correct measurement. So your empirical evidence, your 3, will not disprove your model. Your model will correct your measurement. So it's a rule to describe reality instead of a description of reality. This is quite obvious in such a toy example, but it happens in the sciences. That's the point. It happens in neuroscience. I have a case study in this paper showing that. It happens in physics, and it happens in other domains. Let's say that mathematics, besides being rules of reference sometimes instead of descriptions, they also enjoy a specific and special kind of credibility that other languages or other epistemic objects do not meet for us.
Hang on. I mean, first of all, I would say describing a rule of reality is part of a description of reality. But that seems not what you were saying, right?
No, not exactly. What I mean about mathematics being rules of description is that they are rules that we humans internalize in order to interact with the world. So if you expand the nature to include facts about human beings, then yes, they would be parts of nature as well. But the point is that they would not be parts of physics. So we have a model about physics or a model about neuroscience, and then we humans have internalized rules on how to describe things in neuroscience or things about physics. So these rules are expressed mathematically in the case of models.
But they could also be expressed in a natural language. I mean,
yes, indeed. The difference would be
it's not a specific property of mathematics, no?
That's a very good point, exactly. So actually, later Wittgensteinian philosophy of mathematics has, if I were to summarize it in extremely briefly, it would be about applying the philosophical investigations to mathematics. So things about ordinary language that apply to mathematics as well. So you have ordinary language that can be conceived as a, let's say, as an activity of rule following. There are certain aspects of mathematics that can be reduced to the same rule following that we find in natural science, that we find in natural language. So in this case, then, in this aspect at least, mathematics is not distinctive. Of course, it is distinctive in other aspects. Otherwise, natural language would be as effective in science as mathematics, but it's not. But they both share, according to the later Wittgenstein, they both share this rule following aspect.
Yeah, maybe just to dig deeper in one example, maybe that helps us if we look at it at an example. Is that fine? Because you have this case study mm-hmm. mentioned in neuroscience, where this yeah. process also goes wrong. And maybe that's something that's helpful to yeah. understand the idea. Or
okay. I will try my best to present it in a simple way. So let's go back to the Apple case, because that's the most basic toy case, that you have a 2 plus 2 as a model, and then your empirical findings do not adjust to the model. So what we do is to measure things again, or count things again, or thinking about the things that went wrong. For instance, I lost an apple. Okay, so now let's imagine we have a much more complex model of neuronal activity. And I have a model that predicts the electrical activity of a neuron. What it predicts is that the activity of a certain neuron is Gaussian, in the sense that there's a neuron that has electrical activity only when I'm looking at a certain point in angular space, for instance, here, but it stops firing, doesn't have electrical activity anymore as I move away from that point. So let's say that neuron has a preferred direction, which is 90 degrees, for instance. And when I look away from that direction, then the activity becomes more sparse and it forms a Gaussian curve. So I have a model that includes causal information from other connections in the neural network and so on. And then it, in a way, explains why this neuron fires in this way. And it predicts that it will fire in this Gaussian way. But then we measure the neuron. We actually insert in the brain wires that record the electrical activity of the neurons. And we see that while the activity seems like a Gaussian curve, it's not a perfect Gaussian curve, that certain data points are higher than they should be, others are lower, and so on. So what we usually do in neuroscience is to smooth the data. To smooth the data is to impose the model on the data. So you have the data, it's an imperfect Gaussian. Well, it should be Gaussian according to my model. So I will just smooth the curve and say, well, the neuron actually has a smoother signal. The deviations that I get from the Gaussian is noise, electrical noise, for instance. And there is a point to that. It's not as stupid as it seems, because there's plenty of noise in the brain in how you receive, how you record electrical activity and so on. So for us philosophers, we immediately see that there is epistemic circularity, because the empirical data should falsify the model potentially. But when the data does not match the model, we do not always change the model. We change the data so that it adjusts to the model. But we have to do that because the data is imperfect. So this is something that happens in neuroscience and in physics and in other domains. Mm-hmm. Like models that should be falsified by data actually are a reference for the data. And we adjust the data based on these models. If we do that, of course mathematics is going to be effective, because we are taking the mathematical models as a reference to tune our data. We are doing it ad hoc. This is fine in many cases, and it is essential for science, because think about the Apple example. It helped us realize that we lost an apple, and then we will look around in the supermarket and find the apple that we dropped. It is useful in science as well, because then we clean the electrical noise, and this works in many scenarios. But can also go wrong, because by smoothing data, by using mathematical models as rules of measurement instead of descriptions, we can, let's say, we can mess with the data in ways that we shouldn't, and then we could prevent the discovery of new features, for instance. And this was the case in the neuroscience example that I mentioned in this paper. There are certain neurons whose firing does not adjust to this Gaussian shape, but actually they have two preferred directions. So they have like mm-hmm. two bumps in the signal. And mm-hmm. because the model specifies that there is only one bump in the curve, then what these cells with two bumps were thought to be artifacts of measurement. That there were two neurons that were stuck together in the process of measurement. So this is an artifact. So it took almost 20 years for us to realize that these neurons existed. Why? Because we were using the model as a rule of description, as a rule of what counts as good measurement. And this is the point. It can go wrong. We may take many years in realizing, but all in all, it as I said, to summarize things, it makes sense that if we use mathematical models as references or as rules of description, then mathematics is going to be effective because we make it that way. Our scientific practice is conform in a way that we adjust our measurements to models.
I'm just an analogy. Sorry, just analogy in perception. It's often like this, that our expectations, what we want, what we think we are going to see, forms what we're actually going to see. Right? This is what was the article? What the cat's brain tells the cat's eye, by Varela. And the point here is that expectations are very important, but they can lead to hallucinations, right? So if we expect something and it doesn't fit with reality, we may hallucinate and think we see something which we didn't see, right? It's also a problem, by the way, for legal proceedings, because often people, witnesses will report something which they were expecting to see instead of what they were actually seeing, right? So it's not really a unique aspect of mathematics, I would say, but it's a general issue
It's not a unique aspect of mathematics, indeed, and your analogy is very mm-hmm. nice, but it's a surprising aspect of mathematics. So mm-hmm.
and
in perception, it's
like the world is written in mathematics is like a quote, right? This Galilean. It's like a fact. It's clear that the nature must follow mathematical uh-huh. systematicities. So I think it's maybe you are preaching to the choir, maybe at this moment to Thorsten, but normally I think a lot of people would think that math has a very objective role.
Yes.
And I mean, there are other mistakes like bad measurements, of course, but it's never like the math that might be a part of the problem, so to speak.
I guess a good analogy with perception is that in vision, for instance, the brain fills some gaps. But the brain's pretty good at filling gaps in vision. Of course, by filling gaps, you are not, well, you are projecting like your inner brain models and then to fill the gaps of reality with that. It can go wrong, of course, but it works fine most of the time. So the confusion with mathematics would be thinking that mathematics is a representation of reality that is absolute in the sense that I would say, look, my vision is absolutely perfect. I have no gaps. I have no blind gaps. Well, I have them, but I don't realize because the brain is filling them. It's something similar.
I mean, I think I always feel a bit put off by this idea that mathematics, in some sense, is there before, and we are, I mean, it's just some modern form of Platonism that mathematics is there, and what we see is sort of the structures which are mathematical. And my view is that mathematics has been evolved by us as a product of cultural evolution, and we have just in a way designed it in this process to be very useful to do exactly what it's good for. Would you agree with this, or is this going a bit
far? There is truth to that, definitely. So I would say it is not incompatible with the other aspect of mathematics. It's not that our models do not evolve. They evolve all the time, and we make them more, let's say, effective for their tasks. Like a model can be fine-tuned by empirical data. Not only can, it should, and it is. But this is not at odds with this other grammatical aspect of the model that makes that that regulates our expectations on reality, or that regulates our measurement procedures or interactions with reality. So let's say we have a modeled an empirical situation that don't match. It depends on the character of this mismatch. I may decide to change how interactive with reality or change the model. In some cases, it's obvious that we should change our models. In others, there's a gray area.
There's another option to do more experiments to find out why this mismatch took place. That's what would be my...
Yeah, of course. That would help, for instance, finding out whether there was a technical problem in the experiment. It could also help telling whether certain experimental results hold only in certain scenarios, in certain contexts, but not others. And then this also leads to improvement in our models. We can say, well, I have performed this experiment in context A and context B. And in context A, I get data that is very close to my model. In context B, I get different data. So maybe this model, or maybe the scope of this model is just A, but it does not apply to B. The other alternative would be, well, my measurements in B were wrong, and my model also applies to B. So I will just smooth my data in B so that it adjusts to the model. And in principle, there is no a priori rule that tells me what I have to do. This is all pragmatics. And this is the point. Whether I change the model or repeat my experiments or smooth the data according to the model, this is just the pragmatics of science. There's no overarching rule for that. There is not a rule of rules, so to say.
I just wanted to say, I mean, those ideas are in philosophy of science everywhere in some form of variations. And like Hempel Oppenheim already had this model of scientific explanations roughly speaking, modus ponens. And of course, whenever you don't get to your conclusion, your modus tollens just tells you you need to get rid of one of the assumptions, but it doesn't tell you which one, right? So you can always pick, you can say, okay, the measurement went fine is an assumption you normally have. Oh, and then you say, oh, this one was wrong. And then this is closely related to some Quinean ideas of this web of beliefs. We have like core beliefs we are not willing to give up. And we have other beliefs that we are happier to give up. And math is normally considered a quite core belief. Normally you don't give up addition. Normally you give up that person is trustworthy from whom I bought 2 times 2 apples and just got 3 in my bag after opening it at home. I mean, we don't,
What do you mean by giving up addition? I mean, we may observe that speeds don't add up, right? So we're not giving up addition, but the application of addition.
Yeah, but that's exactly the point. So even a physical rule that you might have had, speeds add up, is you are more willing to give that up than giving up addition, so to speak. It's like the core is less important than the boundaries. And what's the core is a very subjective thing, right? If you are a hardcore, you want to say
like
that?
If you have a web of beliefs that are intermingled, the point of Quine is that you cannot test a specific strand of that web independently, but you test the web as a whole. If you have an experiment and then you have your addition and then the result of the experiment doesn't match your addition procedures, instead of tuning the strand of addition, you tune a different one, which is my perception is reliable. Well, if you cut that one, then you can preserve the addition. So you are testing the web as a whole, not just addition. There is also a more specific form of this. It's a bit different, but it's Poincaré's conventionalism about geometry. So what Poincaré, he's one of the very early conventionalists about mathematics. He said that many different models of geometry are compatible with the same empirical observations. And because of that, the model of geometry that we stick to is a convention. So it's a convention to which one of the different compatible models with reality I end up with.
Yeah, I was just saying something. I mean, I know you're not so interested in foundations, but I mean, there are sort of inconsistent theories, and they were proposed, right? I mean, obviously Frege is very famous, but that happened again and again. And nowadays, we implement these logical theories on a computer, and then maybe an AI would exploit the inconsistency of our foundations to prove, just following the rules, that 3 equals 4, right? So what do we do now? I mean, we just apply the rules and we come to the result that our inconsistent observation is actually consistent with our rules, right?
I mean, that's a great cut for the second half, so to speak, to Wittgenstein, right? Because this idea of rule following is like a very central part of your other main research branch, if I may call it like that. So is Wittgenstein helping us here?
Well, I don't know if he's helping you in foundational matters or in reasons. It depends on the perspective. But for Wittgenstein, it didn't make sense to add foundations to mathematical practices. So if you have, let's say, a rule, 2 plus 2 is 4, we don't need a rule for that rule, or we don't need a foundation for that rule. The foundation of that rule is already in the practice. It's how I use it in practice. So it's in the same way that natural language doesn't need foundations, and still it's like a conglomerate of rules that are followed, then why should we need foundations for mathematics? Foundations for mathematics would be needed if you think of mathematics as structures that can become vulnerable. And for, you know, the typical Hilbert analogy, mathematics is a building. If it's a building that can collapse, then you need secure foundations. But if mathematics are not structures, but rules, then suddenly you don't need foundations in that sense.
It's just my example. I follow rules, and I have to start. There's a system of rules, you could say, which implements, which corresponds to the foundations. And I mean, I would agree that foundations are not absolute. They're a way to reflect our way to use reasoning and to, an attempt to be more precise, to avoid having to discuss each construction. And we can say, okay, so I don't buy Professor Cantor. I don't buy your proof of the well-ordering theorem. What did you actually use? Yeah. So then we need to go back to really understand the structure of reasoning. So I don't agree with Wittgenstein here.
Shall I say a word on that? I mean Wittgenstein, I think, is a little bit more general in these rule following ideas, saying like that the written rule set never really determines the practice. And I mean, they're very parallel sayings in the philosophy of math, like when Penmedi says mathematicians work one step back from disaster, she means, yeah, we work with naive comprehension, and then we see that doesn't work out, and then we try to keep as much comprehension as we can, or do the type theory way of things, but it's like, so to speak, a minimal reparation, as little as possible. And there's this kind of meta rule, don't abuse the contradiction. I mean, in every day, I'm still using naive comprehension. I don't care whether the sets really exist. I just do comprehension as I wish. And then later I'm thinking, oh, can I really do that when it gets shaky, or when it's a very weird move?
I agree. So, it's not when I start to do something, I want to be very flexible, and I'm prepared to lie a bit and smooth over details and use inconsistent assumptions. But then in the end, if I want to challenge my construction, or not me, maybe somebody else wants to challenge, then I'm sitting down and go down to the very, very steps. And actually, maybe unlike at the time of Wittgenstein, we can do this nowadays. We have computer implementations of logical systems.
Yeah, but I guess if we really get the contradiction there, we will change the rules a little bit. Even if it's a pragmatic thing, don't use AI. They are destroying your code, so to speak. Or maybe it's a technical proper change of things. Mm. Maybe it's something related to the representation of things. And one final sentence, and then I pass over to Rossi, sorry for capturing that, is like, when a formal practice doesn't work, we change the practice by saying that was never the spirit of the rules. Wittgenstein has this tennis example. If you start to throw your tennis ball 2,000 meters in the air, and it takes 5 minutes before it comes down and you hit it over to your opponent, then we will come up with the rule, don't do that, it's boring, it's take too long. While technically there was like nothing in the rule set against throwing things up kilometers in the air, because it never was an issue, so we didn't have the rule. Even in chess, the official guidebook says these rules aren't complete, and if we get a problem, the arbiter has the saying, which came up in the castling rule, which is like an historic fun fact, that if you promote your pawn, you get a new rook. So technically you can castle with that new rook when your king is going two fields up, e4, I think, and the castle jumps over him. And that was never intended to be castling. So we needed to rule it out later by changing the rules. But sorry for that, José.
It's actually a good exposition. So what I would add there is that the deepest aspect in this thing you are saying is that for Wittgenstein, the formulation of a rule, so how a rule is expressed in letters or symbols, underdetermines how a rule should be followed or how rules are followed in a community of people. So you have a rule, say, even a contradiction would work, but I don't want to make such an extreme example. Well, why not? If I have a rule like leave the room and don't leave the room, maybe you are puzzled on how to follow that rule because it's a contradiction. But because the formulation of the rule does underdetermine what I do with it, then I can follow it in different ways. One way would be, well, for this group of people, this rule should be followed in the following way. Leave the room mentally, but not physically. So stay in the room and fall asleep, for instance. So if we apply that, this is called the rule following paradox. If we say that mathematics are rules and that we follow rules when we do mathematics, then mathematics are by definition exposed to the rule following paradox, meaning that we can have our symbols, but then we can follow the symbols in we can use the symbols or follow mathematical derivation or do things with them in different ways. So then the elephant in the room is why most people do things with mathematics almost always the same, in the same manner, like multiplication, addition, and so on. Well, this would not be a fact of mathematics. This would be a fact of the rule followers. Like, they are trained since they are little to follow rules in a similar way. And because of that, they do the same things with the symbols. But it's not because mathematics has a structure that constrains you by virtue of structure to do one thing or the other. But it's a psychological constraint almost, not a structural constraint of mathematics. So if you have a contradiction and cannot use it, it's not because a contradiction is flawed mathematics or because we need to fix our foundations, we should not have contradictions, but rather because we have not been given the proper training to make use of this specific contradiction. And because we don't have that training, then we're puzzled. So that this would be my Wittgenstein's point.
I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that this is sort of turning the actual process around. Because, I mean, first we come up with maybe some ideas or some explanation, or mathematical or some theorems, which we have an intuitive justification, which we think is true. And then we construct the proof, and under challenge, we are prepared to give more and more details about our derivation. And this is a bit like how humans work. Also, when we do moral judgments, we usually come to a conclusion or to a view sort of intuitively based on gut feelings, yeah? But then when we are challenged, we say, oh yeah, this is because of I have this moral principle and that and so on. But it's not that we reason from the moral principles and arrive at our judgment, but it goes the other way around, that we arrive at the judgment and then we post hoc explain how our judgment is constructed. And that's also how mathematics work, right? We have got some intuitive insight or some idea or something which should hold, and then we giving more and more precise arguments why this holds. And here is where foundations, which are not fixed for all times, which are also evolving as part of mathematics, play an important role. That we say, okay, based on these foundations which we share, I can come to this conclusion, and then it's accepted.
Mm-hmm. So actually, that's interesting because the later Wittgenstein was to some extent influenced by intuitionism.
Mm-hmm.
So the scope of the influence is a bit up to debate. But here, I would ask the following. So where do these intuitions come from in the mathematician? So when I test whether something holds or whether I have, let's say, a string of symbols and want to produce the next step, these intuitions, what are their bases? What are their foundations? so to say, because these are not the foundations in the sense of the foundations of mathematics, but the foundations of our intuition. And if we ask that question, I think that we will get closer to the later Wittgenstein.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Brouwer wasn't so interested in formal systems at all. And he also said that there are these ur-intuitions to which we trade back. An important one is also the ability of count, because we can always have the next time. So the next time always goes on, and we get the understanding of the natural numbers. And the other ur-intuition is geometry, that we have an understanding, an intuitive understanding of geometry. And we can mm-hmm. use these basic intuitions to reason. And
Still accepting both? A curious question. I thought that space was till Kant accepted, and then these non-Euclidean geometries got rid about our instincts of space because we could be wrong there. And then Brouwer said, but time is also enough. But maybe I'm confused there. You are the expert on intuitionism.
Maybe not as far as philosophy is concerned. I mean, I read the biography of Brouwer. Mm.
Then you're probably right. Just we need to look.
But maybe I'm mixing. But this was my understanding. I mean, and it's interesting just to trace back to some of the interviews we recently had, where we by Steve Audi especially, where we discussed this interaction between this geometric intuition and the sort of more algebraic, sort of discrete intuition, and how they interact and lead to new ideas like this modern type theory.
Once we are there and we are getting closer to understanding, then what is the relationship between foundations in the standard sense and the foundations of the intuitions of the mathematician? Is one sufficient? If one of the two is sufficient for mathematical practice, which one of the two is sufficient? If you had to drop one,
I don't think that makes any sense. I mean, our intuition is our main guidance, and it's the way we work, the way we think, and when we do mathematics, then both the rules and the foundation. I mean, you could say the rules are consequent, the precise rules are expressed in our foundations. I was just thinking earlier that you could say that Russell was abusing the principle of comprehension. Yeah, I mean, as you said, so he used the rule in a way which wasn't actually intended by Cantor or by Frege, right? And hence he did exactly this what you described earlier, right? And then people later came up with different approaches how to stop this abuse, right? I mean, ZFC or type theory, a la Martin Loeb, they are all attempts to make these rules of comprehension and so on precise in a way that they hopefully cannot be abused. But we never know, right? So
I'm thinking that, in a way, the foundations, the standards in the standard sense, could be, they in a way reflect our intuitions. So there is not a strong demarcation between the two senses of foundation. But, the foundations also in turn guide our intuitions. So what I wanted to get... right here is that it seems like the foundations in the standard sense are subordinate to intuition. First, they come from intuition. Second, they tune our intuitions. So in a way, it seems like the intuitions are they prime over mathematical foundations. If we already agree on that, then the next step, the more radical version, that would be the Wittgensteinian one, would be it is our rule-following practices that prime so much over everything else that everything else is almost meaningless. So why would you want to ground 2 plus 2 equals 4 in foundations, or better, 1 plus 1 equals 2, because this is the famous example from the Principia Mathematica, Why do you want to ground that on logical foundations, for instance, a la Russell style, if you already have solid intuitions about 1 plus 1 equal 2 and how that behaves? How is that going to improve your mathematical practice? I'm not saying that it doesn't. I'm saying that
So it improves it because there has been always arguments about mathematical arguments. I mean, there is this famous book by Imre Lakatos, right? About like obviously proof and refutation, right? That certain proofs are not acceptable. And okay, he describes it correctly as a dialectic process, and foundations play a role in this dialectic process, because in the end we say, okay, now we established the rules we agree on, and this way we avoid having this discussion about every construction, whether we accept it or not, but we put down the law, like we do in legal proceedings as well, right? It's not that we each time when we have a potential misdemeanor that we try to reason based on moral principles, but that we say, okay, hang on, here we have some rules, we have some law, and we simplify the process by saying you have followed the law or you haven't followed the law. That's the point of foundations, right?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. Actually, I provide a rational reconstruction of Lakatos with Wittgensteinian philosophy. So I know this point, and I really accept it. Then we are ascribing a function to foundations that is not very standard. It's like they are clarificatory. They're like in a legal context. You have this rule, and then this applies to many cases. But the point, and here I would follow the rule following paradox again, is that clarifications on how to follow a rule are helpful, but they do not solve the rule following paradox, because then the rule following paradox applies to the clarification itself. So now that I have more, I know that the rule is longer, so to say, when I have clarified it, now how do I apply it? And I find the problem again. Of course, I control it sometimes it's practical, because I can control the rule in a better way, but it doesn't fully solve the problem. And I mean, the rules of mathematics are already kind of well controlled compared to other rules, but still they suffer from this problem, as the foundational problems show. But let me think how I would put this in a
let me just add something
in a simple way.
I mean, as we know from Gödel, whatever foundational theory we have, we cannot use it to prove the consistency of these very foundations, right? So there is this, I mean, what you describe as a rule-following paradox is a sort of incompleteness of this rule-following principle in a similar sense as Gödel describes incompleteness as an incompleteness of the foundation idea, right? It's always a self-application, which is exactly what you're doing, right? That if you apply the foundations to the questions about foundations, then obviously
I have thought of another example that I think would clarify this, and it's an analogy to what you said about a legal code with things, with stipulations about what to do in each case. Well, legal codes actually suffer from the rule following paradox as well, because the concepts they use are open textured. Like we have rules on monopolies, for instance. You have a monopoly, you have to split your company in half. And you have that well codified in legal codes in many countries. But then the problem is, in a Lakatosian sense, what is a monopoly? What is the definition of monopoly? And then you have a definition of monopoly. Well, a company that controls all the, say, the, for instance, the production of a certain good. And then we have a case like Apple and the iPhone. Apple was sued for monopoly over the App Store, because the App Store is a monopoly. It means that you have an iPhone, you cannot have any other app store, only Apple's app store. You can only buy apps in the Apple's app store. So Apple can afford to take a 30% cut of the price of the app. So it was sued for a monopoly. But then Apple said, no, this is not a monopoly, because monopoly does not, whether this is a monopoly or not, does not apply at the level of the apps in my phone. It applies at the level of phones. And there are other producers of phones. There is Samsung, there is Xiaomi, there are other brands of phones. So I do not hold a monopoly. So then the definition of monopoly in the legal code, to what does it apply? To the apps within a phone or to the phone market? And then you don't know how to follow the rule anymore. Then you have found the rule following paradox. You can do two different things that both conform to the rule. And that's the problem of the foundations, that sometimes they can be pragmatic because they clarify rule following. But many other times, they don't. They are just extra symbols in the string. Because in principle, they're still subjected to the rule following paradox.
We know that José still wanted to show us something about Wittgenstein and Turing, right? Which is probably also related to foundation, something he wrote a while ago and is about to finalize.
It's fine. I had it prepared just in case, because I think it, just in case we went into the Turing versus Wittgenstein debate. But it's also good in this context because it illustrates Wittgenstein's view of mathematics a bit more clearly with a picture. So this view that mathematics is not about structures, but about rules. And for this reason, we can afford to have contradictions and so on, because there's nothing special about them. It's just something else that can be followed like any other rule, and that are subjected to the rule following paradox, just like any other rule, just like in legal codes. So there is nothing distinctive about them. And that's why paradoxes are acceptable in mathematics. So
I would be open to have this experiment. It's, of course, for our listening audience, a little unideal, but we wanted to try it as an experiment and are happy to get feedback, and might ask our guests in future to prepare such a small slide presentation if they want, but it's not obligatory, and only if the feedback is positive. And before you start, let me do one tiny advertisement, because José, I and Colin Jakob Rittberg, who was a guest here, wrote about Joel Hemkins, who was also a guest here, his multiverse theory, and we made there a Wittgensteinian take on his ideas of the multiverse, because he's saying in a nutshell, in three lines, he wrote something: we should not try to settle the continuum hypothesis because of our experience in CH and non-CH set theoretic universes. So to speak, we use this Wittgensteinian notion of petrification. Something can become a rule, it can harden to a rule which wasn't a rule all the time. And so nowadays you might argue for the rule don't settle CH, because then you lose a lot of set theoretic practice, while you normally might have had the rule try to settle mathematics statement, whichever statements are mathematical. I mean, the Gödel statement might not be mathy, so don't care about it, but CH is, so care about it and come up with new axioms and to settle it one way or the other. But Thorsten disagrees with that.
No idea. I agree completely. I just would question AC as well.
ACO, I said CH. Maybe it's too hot here. CH was what I wanted to call. The axiom of choice is, of course, not that problematic in some
it's
sense.
It's very problematic. It's absolutely problematic. I fundamentally disagree here.
But I mean, it clearly follows from ZFC. And it clearly doesn't follow from ZFC. ZF.
That's of course. What is this called? This ossification. Oh, it follows from ZFC. Oh, it's fine. Okay. And you just gave a prime example of ossification. Thank you very much.
It follows from ZFC. It's like similar to the model example. Like the model follows from the data. Of course, the data is made up by the model.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a a thing we do in math all the time. Oh, Banach-Tarski paradox. Mm. We learn about it. It's evidence against AC. And after a time, we just use it to teach AC and say, look, cool, weird sets. same with physics, like the, what was the name of the cat? The cat in the
Schrödinger,
box.
Schrödinger's
cat. Yeah. It was an argument against quantum physics, and now we use it as didactical material. But I talked way too long, and Jose, you wanted to talk about Wittgenstein and Turing for a few more minutes. So please, let us try the experiment. So
just briefly to illustrate Wittgenstein's view on mathematics. So in the lectures on the foundations of mathematics, which is a short book about Wittgenstein's lectures in Cambridge, where he taught many students that would eventually become world-class mathematicians, like Turing, Wittgenstein actually tried to convince them of their of his own particular use of mathematics, and this is how it went. Well, this is a part of how it went. Let's see if I can share my screen.
Yeah.
Okay.
Analogy so, 5.
Oh, yeah, because there are many, actually. This is a slide from a talk that I gave some time ago on the analogies that Wittgenstein used to convince Turing about his view of mathematics. So what Wittgenstein does with this analogy is quite interesting, because this analogy does not represent Wittgenstein's view of mathematics and logic. It represents Turing's view. And when Turing is not persuaded that paradoxes are not that much of a problem in mathematics, that contradictions are not that much of a problem in mathematics, because you can just tune the pragmatics of your rule following and follow paradoxes and contradictions in different ways. When Turing appeals to the structure of mathematics to still insist in the point that contradictions are structural problems, and because of that something would go wrong in the real world with contradictions, Wittgenstein says, okay, you think of mathematics in the following way. Like, you have a cogwheel in the left, and then you actually have a full system of cogwheels, a structure of cogwheels. So whatever you do in the first one determines, by virtue of structure, what the other cogwheels will do. So there is no pragmatics here. And if something happens to the first, something will happen to the last, and it is perfectly determined. So this is like a formal system, a formal structure. So as what you have the quote below, it says, its movement determines the movement of the last cogwheel in the chain. So there's a determination relationship. And because of this, if you take mathematics to be that, then a system of cogwheels like the one you see now cannot ever work. Like a contradiction in the typical way of dealing with it, it can never work. If you attempt to turn one of the cogwheels, the system itself is jammed, so it will not turn. So for this, for Turing, that who thinks of mathematics in the typical structural sense, in this sense of structure, a contradiction cannot work because it is jammed language. Like if I say, leave the room and don't leave a room, that will not work, because formally speaking, that's a contradiction. And that's why we need secure foundations, so that we not reach these contradictions and our mathematics do not jam like this. But for Wittgenstein, mathematics are not structures. They are not a system of cogwheels. They are rules. Because of being rules, they're subjected to the rule-following paradox, and the rules can be followed in many different ways. Good ways, bad ways, economic ways, whatever. So the point is what our training is and other facts of us as humans. Like there are some rules that are easier for us to execute or remember and so on. So rule following is about humans, not about structures of language or structures of mathematics. So a contradiction would work as long as I have the training, or let's say the ability, of making it work. but it's not per se structurally jammed. And this is why for Wittgenstein, you don't need secure foundations. Because if you find a contradiction, you just need a good way of using that rule, which would be, well, let's say you have the liar paradox. So the paradox, the liar lies, therefore it does not lie, and so on. And therefore, you have that 5 times 5 is 325 because of the principle of explosion. Then the rule would be, do not derive anything from a contradiction. Then you're safe from contradictions. Or find another way to use it, like in the leave the room and don't leave the room. So for Wittgenstein, this view, this metaphysical view of mathematics, that mathematics constitute structures, like and certain analogies, like the Gogwill analogy or Hilbert's analogy of the building, they reflect the metaphysical view that mathematics are almost like physical objects. But Wittgenstein says this is actually a confusion, that mathematics should not be seen as physical objects. They are quite similar to ordinary language. And because of that, we can do similar things as we do in ordinary language without losing what makes mathematics special. And maybe making it more economic, more economical, because you don't need so much foundational work. Paying attention to the pragmatics of mathematics, because if we insist in the structural view of mathematics, then the pragmatics are just an afterthought, while they should be much more important, as we have been saying in this interview, and so on. So yeah, I thought this was a neat way of presenting what Turing's and most people's views, even for the intuitionists sometimes, are about mathematics, and what could be an alternative way of saying mathematics.
I don't think I have most people's view, or maybe I don't think mathematics is anything holy or foundations are absolute, but I think this Wittgenstein view, there's this place, a deep misunderstanding what's the role of logic in mathematical reasoning. Yes, this is part of the mathematical practice, that we try to avoid contradictions and we try to design systems which are contradiction-free to be able to simplify our reasoning and play the role we have discussed previously, which foundations should play. And hence, to play this role, they should be contradiction-free, otherwise they're useless, and Turing is perfectly right.
I mean, you can disagree, which is fine. And maybe another example is like Dirac's delta function. So that may be something that could help clarifying that. Jose, do you want to
explain it? Dennis and I published a paper about that. First, to engage with what you just said, Thorsten, we could also say that having contradictions in our mathematics is inconvenient from a practical point of view, because typically we don't know what to do with them. They confuse us, they puzzle us, and it's not convenient to have them. That's another thing.
They show that there's something wrong in the design of our logical system, which is exactly Turing's point, right?
Turing's point, and that's different from what Wittgenstein
says. There is a problem in the design of this foundational system, which in no way is absolute, which is a reflection of our intuition or our practice, whatever. But it's a point of reference. And as a point of reference, it is important to have this property of being contradiction-free. So I think it's.
I mean, Turing refers to real-world implication. He says bridges will collapse if we have contradictory arithmetic, because engineers will use that. But the bridges then will be structurally unsound, so to speak, as an example.
Yeah, but even in pure mathematics, like the point is, if we need to design, and here we're using already like an analogy, like design the foundation so that they're contradiction-free, we are already like, in a way, coming back to the structural analogy. Like we need to design the base of the building so that the building doesn't collapse. While... For Wittgenstein, the point would be, maybe we need to steer clear of contradictions, but not because they constitute something structural in mathematics, not because they need to be part of a design and so on, but just because they are inconvenient. So there are two ways of reaching a similar conclusion, but from different point of views.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
So at some point, Wittgenstein told Turing, like, maybe it's fine for you to avoid contradictions because they confuse you. In that case, I'm perfectly fine with you doing that. But you are doing that for a different reason. The first reason, I mean, the Wittgensteinian one, allows for the possibility that certain contradictions are trouble-free because we know what to use with them. And this is where the delta function example comes in. Like, the delta function is it was criticized by the more mathematics-driven physicist as being unrigorous because it contained contradictions. And the more practical physicists said, this is not a problem. It is already economical as it is, and it is perfectly under control because we know what to do with it. So why invest the resources in making it rigorous in the sense that it does not contain any possible contradiction when it's not going to make any difference at all? We already work fine with the delta function, and we still do these days. So
yeah, well, this
as is- long as we are provided with the training to work with the delta function in a nice way, why work with the symbols in a more messy way to have something that is different? Because this is where the structural anxieties come in. Because if you think mathematics is a structure, then the delta function is an imperfect structure. But if mathematics are not structures, then maybe we can work with the mathematics in a more economical way.
I mean, I agree that okay, this is a typical conflict between physicists and mathematicians, right? I mean, there are similar situations even when I want to construct something, I often make inconsistent assumptions. Or, for example, I ignore in type theory, ignore the universe hierarchy because it's just lots of extra work. And obviously, I do exactly what you say. But I'm aware of this imperfection. And actually, my friend Ralf Mattes, he just told me last week at the Types meeting, he says he inadvertently actually used basically Russell's paradox to prove something which was wrong. So in the end, we may in the sort of in the everyday use, we may do exactly this. We work maybe in an inconsistent system, or we don't use foundations, or we wave our hands. But at some point, when we are asked to provide more evidence, then it's the point when we need to refer to some foundations which are shared. So the point about foundations is also not that they're absolute, that they're shared between different people. And then we can say, okay, according to the foundations, you need to refine what you're doing. Otherwise, it's unsound and possibly the grid will collapse. Yeah.
I would say what they share is a notion on how to follow rules when we are when we face a contradiction. So if you have, they say, Russell's paradox, that's bad if you like you can have that in your system, because most people, when they find Russell's paradox, they are allowed or they feel allowed to derive anything from it. But that's because, let's change the focus. Let's not say that they share the Russell's paradox. What they share is what to do with Russell's paradox. I can now derive anything from it. Well, we also share the pragmatics, at least. We need to concede that. So we may have Russell's paradox in a context where we do not share those pragmatics, and then Russell's paradox is not a problem anymore.
No, I don't agree. I mean, as I said, it's a problem exactly, because you may inadvertently use this, and that's not so obvious.
To use it inadvertently, you need to have interiorized this rule-following procedure. Like, you can use it inadvertently.
No, but
because
you've been
trained to use the theorem of explosion, the principle of explosion. Sorry.
Yeah, but you may have a theorem which you think is intuitively true, but it's not true in all cases. And now you prove it to be true in all cases by inadvertently use Russell's paradox. And now you claim that it's applicable for a case for which it isn't, and the bridge falls down. So at this point, somebody says, Hoyan, your derivation here, I think you made you appealed to a principle which I don't buy and which is not valid in our foundation. So please fix this. And by fixing it, you avoid the bridge falling down.
Let me just try maybe some final words because we are over an hour long and I know
We can maybe continue another time. That's an interesting discussion.
Definitely. Let me just say something. Wittgenstein was always stressing that humans are rule benders. So they are fine with cheating with the rules whenever they cause something that you cannot live with, so to speak, for instance. God isn't seeing what happens when if I close the window, if the rules of my religion are too strict or something like that. People use these points of relief. And computers don't. So for somebody doing formal mathematics, it's much more an issue to have paradoxes than for somebody not formalizing. I mean, even living in a world where you do math without caring about foundation, without knowing foundations, which just most of the time goes right with your intuitions, with your quite formal reasoning in layman's terms, but totally unrigorous reasoning in formal derivation terms. And it goes wrong all the time. If you look into the literature, you will find so many wrong results in the literature. Everybody knows that. Especially the details don't matter too much. Maybe the theorem is right, but the proof was wrong. We are in this situation all the time. But so the issue is really pragmatical and it shows. And now I should be careful saying Jose is not a rule follower. I think he lives within the law. but maybe it's something that shows that Thorsten's more rule following, more rigorous in that sense. Not
as a German, maybe, no.
I'm Turkish, Kurdish, German. I'm the biggest paradox of you all, very rule followy and very rule bendy at the same time.
Maybe a very small comment that is also a small ad. It's about what you said about computers not being subjected to the same pragmatics as human rule followers. And that's why computers do not have this tolerance to, let's say, for instance, a contradiction because they cannot adjust the rule following and so on. We actually, Dennis and I, have a paper in philosophy and technology where we say that it is actually the basis of the alignment problem of AI, that humans follow rules in a certain way, but then machines follow rules in a different way. The way that machines follow rules, if they follow rules, which is another thing, is more mechanical. But humans are not mechanical actually, in this sense. So that's why we need to be careful on how with the difference between doing mathematics by a human and a machine or
but actually, any other LLMs rule follow. Are very flexible. LLMs are very flexible in their rule following. They're quite happy to cheat even
and
more
that's
than
an
humans.
Interesting discussion should really have there. I mean, there we talk more
there's
about
something in the paper
these horror types, computer science as a science, write everything formal, mindset versus this data-driven approaches. We contrast that in the paper. But maybe we should speak about that in another episode because I got a lot of messages that we should talk more about AI. Mm-hmm. So maybe we have like a special sub-season with 5 episodes which focus on AI mostly rather than logic mostly because they are intertwined anyway. Having said that, let me say thank you to Thorsten and Jose. I think it was a lovely chat.
Yeah.
And do one final advertisement. And that is now our Buy Me a Coffee is online in the real world timeline. So we record this after that. So now I'm doing an advertisement that we didn't do in the first episodes of the season because back then it wasn't online. We are happy about the support or the post-production costs a little bit of money. If you feel especially generous, feel free to do that. And after a while, we will think about more benefits and memberships and other formats, but that's not to be discussed today. Let me just say again, thank you so much, José. Is there any last words you want to share?
Well, I'm very thankful to you too for inviting me and be able to say this crazy things that Wittgenstein said. So
Wittgenstein was clearly not consistent with his set of beliefs.
He was a bit paraconsistent. we need to admit that.
Yeah, and it was a productive program of Wittgensteinian philosophy. At least some think, others think it's garbage, but that's I think true for more or less every intellectual endeavor.
I think we need to take the good things with us, but of course that's not implied we should accept everything that he said. So rather than Wittgenstein's philosophy, we need Wittgensteinian philosophy.
Yeah, great. Then have a great day.
Okay.
And
bye-bye.
Subscribe, comment, and we will reply to as many comments as possible. Most of the time, actually all. Then bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.